Okay, guys. This is the third and last of the series. I want to. Last week we actually jumped. I actually skipped 2 points I wanted to make last week, and we moved. Let me just back a little bit. We have to divide the history. Oh, I'll wait for it. Right? All right, start again. Last week, I jumped at a middle piece that I want to fill in now, and then we'll come back to Ashkenaz. When we talk about Sephardic Rishonim, we have to make a very clear distinction. Sephardi commentary on the Gemara is actually divided into two stages. The first stage was the one we talked about. It culminates more or less with the Rambam. All those things we mentioned about the Rambam apply to the people who came before. We talked about the Rif. We talked about the idea of a singular truth and so on. And the fact that Sephardim didn't and never actually moved off of the presumption that the function or the basic goal of learning Gemara is lasuke shmatita aliba dehilchata, to end up coming to a proper halachic conclusion, which means that getting sidetracked on apparently non-central tangents is not certainly not a characteristic of the first wave of Sephardic activity. And I mentioned in passing that all of this activity happens in what is called the so-called Golden Age in Spain, which, again, I mentioned, it depends. If you take it from the point of view of what they used to call convivencia, that Arabs and Jews love each other and everybody has equal rights and all this other stuff, it never happened. It never happened, can't happen, because Islam cannot allow for non-Muslims to have equal rights. It's just written into the Quran. There's no way around it. The Quran, the Hadith, their Torah Shebal Peh, and so on. If we're talking about a golden age of Jewish creativity, which was stimulated by the interaction with Arabs, then you have a golden age. But again, it's got nothing to do with their political status. It's got everything to do with their own internal creativity. One of the more interesting things about the Jews sort of come and go, and nobody pays attention. I have no idea if this was done on purpose, but in the 60s, he passed away since, I don't know if you're familiar with the actor Charlton Heston. Moses from the Ten Commandments. Oh, Moses. He played a lot of historical figures. One of the figures he played was Rodrigo de Vivar, who's the national hero of Spain. He's known as Rodrigo de Vivar el Campeador, the leader or the conqueror, and he's also known as El Cid. And there was a movie with him and Sophia Loren that was put out in the 60s, and the subtext of them, it's a wonderful movie, and I think I think the whole thing is on YouTube, so it's really one of these bombastic Hollywood movies. In any event, the subtext is that Christians and Muslims can get along if they only want. And the whole story is against the background of the invasion of Spain by fanatics from North Africa known as the Almoravids, led by a guy named Ben Yusuf, who appropriately is all dressed in black, as opposed to everybody else is dressed in colors, and so on and so forth. But what's striking is the whole discussion is always about Christians and Moors. And it's like Jews were not in Spain. And this is the middle of the so-called Golden Age. It's one of the most stunning examples of history being written without, and Jews don't appear. I just put up on my Facebook page today something similar, and what you'll encounter as you get to call a university a lot. There is a book that a friend of mine, who's a fellow medievalist, has called "Violence in the Middle Ages." So, what does an academic do? When a Jewish academic do when he sees a book like that, he looks in two places. First, he looks in the bibliography to see if he gets quoted. In this case, I had no expectations because I haven't written on this subject at all. And then I look to see under Jews. And in a really significant volume on violence in the Middle Ages, there's no entry for Jews in the whole book, which is stunning when you consider that much, if not most, of the violence in the Middle Ages, let's say much of the Middle Ages, was vented on Jews. And they're just not there. So much for the. So you've got to realize that the situation of Jews in medieval Europe is somewhat at issue. And anyways, there wasn't the Golden Age in Spain. Whatever it was, an end to it was put in 1148 when another wave of I guess we call them Muslim jihadi fundamentalists, which just means they're very firm Muslims. invade Spain from the again from North Africa. They are known as the Almohadim, the Almohades, and they basically force all non-Muslims in. First of all, they force the Muslims to firm up. Second of all, they force all non-Muslims either to convert to Islam or die. So many, many Jews run to the north of Spain. Other Jews go into hiding. Others run away, among them being the family of the Rambam, who hangs up, manages to pass somehow in Spain for a certain amount of time. Then they run to Fez, which is a little bit strange, because that was the capital of the Almohads. But then there were Jews who survived World War II in Berlin, so anything's possible. And the minute they were able to get out, they went to Eretz Israel and finally to Egypt. Anyways, the Almohadim basically put an end to anything significant in Muslim Spain. They destroyed the yeshivot, they destroyed everything that was in their path, and it took at least a generation and a half for the Jews in northern Spain to get themselves reorganized, to try to set up some kind of a cultural life. And the truth is, until the last quarter of the 12th century, there is no significant Torah activity in northern Spain. In other words, the same world that had given us the Rif and the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda al-Bar Galoni and Rabbi Yitzchak al-Baliya and Rabbi Yossi Rahosef ibn Migash and so on, nothing goes on. And the first person who comes to who arises is a man whose name you may very well have heard in the course of the year so far. His name was Rabbi Meir Halevi Abu Lafia. He is known for his Sfarim known as the Yad Ramah. Rabbi Meir Halevi, the Ramah is Reish Mem Hey, Rabbi Meir Halevi. He lived in Toledo. If you go to Spain to this day, you can still see medieval Toledo. It's worth visiting. It was the home not only of the Ramah, but also later on of the Rosh and the Balaturim. Two of the major shuls are still standing, although they've turned into churches, especially Reb Santa Maria de Blanca Transit Shul, the Transit Synagogue, the Shmuel Halevi. And he really takes the first step towards restoring Torah life in Spain. In an interesting sense, we'll talk about this in a minute, by moving into Christian Spain, he basically reorients himself intellectually, and for the first time, to a significant degree anyways, a Talmud Chacham of the first caliber comes in contact with the traditions of Ashkenaz. We now think that for many, many years we thought that the Rambam never heard of Rashi. I mean, can you imagine? The Rambam learned without Rashi. He never heard of Tosfos. He barely heard of the Ravid. There is a legend that the Rambam at the end of his life, I mean, here's stories about the Rambam at the end of his life, I begin to wonder, right? But he said, this is legend at the end of his life, the Rambam said, Me'olam lo nitzchuni ela hazaken hazeh, that no one ever bested me in argument except for this old man in Paskir, the Ravid. But we don't know if it's a really authentic statement or not. And those people always pass like the Rambam. Certainly think it's not true because, you know, we never pass. Why would you pass like the Ravid when you have the Rambam? But in any event, now there are indications that, in fact, that the Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash actually had heard of Rashi, had some commentaries of Rashi. Of course, he flourished and wrote after Rashi died or towards the end of Rashi's life, so it's possible. But nevertheless, coming into contact with the full creativity of what Ashkenaz produced, which we'll talk about today, really only starts with the Yad Ramah. And yet, nevertheless, it doesn't have that much of an impact on his book, the Yad Ramah. Originally, we only had Baba Basra and Sanhedrin. Now we have, as you probably know, did any of your Ramim quote the Yad Ramah in Kiddushin? Okay, so now this Yad Ramah Kiddushin comes from a relatively recently published. It comes from a manuscript, a partial manuscript that was not available previously. Now we have a whole bunch of other Maseftas, Gittin also. In general, he is very, 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 he remains very much in the tradition that we talked about, La Suki Shmat Tali, but the Hilchata, no, very little Pilpul, a little bit of Baliatosis. Not all that significant. Certainly his major goal in life is to strengthen and to advance and to finalize the traditions of Andalusian Spain, which had been destroyed. Okay, so That's number one. Stage two of Spain is a whole different ballgame. That's when Spain meets the Ballet Tausus, but in order to do that, we have to talk about who the Tausus were, and then we'll be able to get a sense of what was going on. So it goes like this. It goes, Rashi, and the and Rabbeinu Gershom are parallel in time, in the 11th century, the thousands up until 1148, with the early Spartan, including the Ron. Then there's a big break in Spain, during which the world changes in France. And that's the change I want to talk about, at least right now. We talked about what Rashi achieved. We talked about the fact that in Ashkenaz under Rabbeinu Gershom, a sort of collective group, perush, line by line, had begun to be developed in the yeshivas. What Rashi did was to take much of that material and also stuff that hadn't actually been created, and to create it line by line, a line by line perush on the Gemara, which provides all of the information you need to be able to learn on your own, meaning background information, meanings of words, punctuation, cross references to a certain degree, and so on. No longer do you have to sit, if you want to know a masechta, do you have to sit in yeshiva and just memorize whatever they're teaching you. Now the whole thing's laid out in front. You can go here, you can go there, you can find parallels. The entire Ashas is open to is open for study and for conquest and for analysis. It is a fundamentally democratic action, because now really can. You need, if you have a basic Hebrew education, which almost every Ashkenazi male had, you can just sit and learn. You shouldn't spend time with the Talmud Chacham to know methodology, but once you've got a basic entry, you're okay. You're okay. Now, question is, did most Ashkenazim know how to learn? The answer is apparently yes. In the 12th century in France, there was a Christian. A famous Christian philosopher whose name was Peter Abelard. He lived in Paris. He had a student who complains about the fact that among the Christians, everybody's illiterate, even the nobility, they're all illiterate. They send one kid to be a churchman because there wasn't enough land to go around to give everybody, so you send them to become a priest, and everybody else is illiterate, literally illiterate. They don't know anything, they can't read, they can't write, nothing. Okay? That's why all of the secretaries to all of the kings and stuff were all priests, because they weren't not read and write. He says, this is terrible. Look at the Jews. Every single son of the Jews knows how to read and write and study. Now, why is this statement important? Because the last person in the 12th century who's going to say something complimentary and positive about Jews is a churchman. So if a churchman's already saying it, it's sort of like if the head of Chinuch Atzmoy got up and said, everyone who lives in our yeshivas is Talmud Chacham, okay, you know, I would take it with a grain of salt, because he wants to raise money among the Americans and he wants to support all the yeshivas. But if already a churchman is saying it, then I can be a little bit more confident in saying they reflect an actual reality. All right, now, once Rashi's commentary is completed, and as I said, he commented on almost every, probably on it, most likely on every Masechet and Shas, even though we don't have every one of those Perushim. First of all, it never had to be done again. And all the other commentaries which competed, or which were used up until that time, fell away. Rabbeinu Hananel, for example, I mentioned last time. At that point, enters Rashi's grandson. His youngest grandson, Yaakov, who was just a little kid when Rashi died. We know him. He's known to history as not as just Yaakov ben Meir, but as who? Rabbeinu Tam. Why Rabbeinu Tam? Yaakov Yishtam, Yoshev Ohalim. Together with his nephew, whose name was Rabbi Yitzchak ben Shmuel of Dompierre, Rashi's great grandson, in other words. They worked a revolution which changed the face of Torah study forever. Okay. Whereas, up until including the time of the Rambam, there was this idea that you could actually codify every single thing that the Gemara has to say. Comes Rabbeinu Tam and says, look it. The Gemara was redacted by Ravina and Ravashi in a way that it's a fundamentally integrated and authorized work. Therefore, every single element in the Gemara is by definition significant. This fits into this whole idea that I talked about last week about omniscience and the fact that there can be more than one answer to any given question. Therefore, it's not relevant, it's not proper to say, it's not possible to say that the Gemara contains contradictions. Yes, it represents different people's opinions, but it was put together by Ravina and Rav Ashi in a way that didn't allow for that. It might as well have passed muster with Ravina and Rav Ashi. And therefore, even the Havaminas, even those intermediate stages that we talked about last week, the Okimtas, are significant. Yes, an Okimta might be in fact, an Okimta might be in fact rejected or proven to be irrelevant to a specific discussion. You have Machlok Zabayev and Rava. The Rava quotes a Bryce and Abaya says, no, you can interpret it that way, so there's no, you can't make a determination based on that. But the Havamina of the Okimta is based on an idea. Things are thought through. And if those things, and if those Havaminas contradict open Gemaras, never mind situations in which there are two sugyas that contradict each other lichora openly, well, you have two choices. The Sephardic position was to say that one sugya must be right and one sugya must be wrong, or do it a little bit more elegantly, one sugya is central and one sugya is less central. Obviously, okay. Oh, I'll give an example. Obviously, for example, there's a machlokas in the Gemara about what the parameters are of what non-Jewish behaviors are allowed. I'm not going to go into the long details. So, din of chukos akum, b'chukoseim lo seleichu. One sugi is in Sanhedrin, and one sugi is in Avodah Zarah. Happens to be that the sugi in Avodah Zarah is more makel than the sugi in Sanhedrin. So, which do you choose? So the Sephardim come in, the Ran says this explicitly on the Daf, on Daf Yud Aleph Mud Aleph in Avodah Zarah. He says, you go with the Sugya Shmatita. Where is the obvious place, the central halakhic place, the obvious place to discuss relations with non-Jews? In Sanhedrin or in Avodah Zarah? In Avodah Zarah! See, a pasuk like the Sugya in Avodah Zarah. That's called the Sugya Shmatita. That's how the Rambam works. If you have a steer with two Sugyas, and one is more centrally, contextually appropriate. The other time the discussion is sort of like schlepped up, by the way, Agav Grara. So you go with the central discussion. That's the standard, that was the standard operating procedure among Sephardim. In fact, you find it still among Rav Avadi Yosef's Tshuvas and elsewhere. Okay? Tosfos is nothing doing! Since when did Chazal say anything that's not significant? If Chazal say, ostensibly say contradictory things in two different contexts, they must be referring to two different issues, or two different aspects of the same issue. There's got to be an underlying reason, okay, for them to have expressed themselves in apparently contradictory fashions. So what do? You make a chilek. You make a distinction. Over here, they're talking about this. First, you can say this one. First of all, you could say very simply that's Lishitase, that this sugya reflects this opinion and this sugya reflects this opinion, whether it's Amorayim, Tanayim, whatever it is. Or you can say, but no, this sugya, based on the overall context over here, refers to this issue in this context, and this sugya refers to this issue in a different context with different ramifications. For example, in the case of the issue I was talking about what non-Jewish behaviors are allowed and what not, says Rabbi Yitzchak of Dompierre, says the Ri, the Sugyan of Avodah Zarah is talking about adopting ritual activity that is adopting Christian ritual customs. I don't know, wearing a Roman collar, or having an organ and shawl, whatever it could be, okay? Whereas in Sanhedrin, which is talking about the general function of a Jewish polity, the question over there is a question of under what circumstances can we imitate general non-Jewish governmental behavior. Okay? So the criteria for this is different than the criteria for that. You follow? By doing that, both sugyas are right. But there's more than that. By doing that, you've also created new concepts which then you can plug in elsewhere. Oh, all, once I know there's a distinction to be made between things that are specifically religious that come out of non-Jewish here, not the non-Jewish world, and things which are developed in a sort of, well, I don't want to use the word because it's not appropriate, but it's, I have no better word, secular context. Oh, so maybe that applies elsewhere. In other words, by contrast, by comparing and contrasting and distinguishing, you get a whole new range of concepts and ideas which shed light on vast numbers of other sugyas. So that the, and the number of possibilities that arise is endless. So that you basically, what Tosfos basically does is you expand the halakhic universe. The possibilities, instead of becoming chiseled in stone, end up becoming endless. The halakhic horizons just keep getting broader and broader. If you will, lumdus comes into the world. Not in the, not totally yet in the sense that we think of it, but very similar. All right? And in a word, in the world, in, according to Balei Tosfos, the Gemara, since the Gemara is a closed, self-contained book, everything relates to everything else. That's why you can make Dimuyim, you can be Madame Milsa Milsa, and all kinds of things, because you look more deeply into the inner structure and the underlying assumptions of the questioners and the answer, and the, people give the answers, the Makshin, the Tarsin, whatever the case might be. You assume intelligence on the part of Chazal, which is always a good thing to do, that they don't ask stupid questions. So if a question is raised and the objection is obvious, well, what was he thinking? If the objection is so obvious, okay. So that's number one. That's the first thing Tosfos does. Your possibilities of analysis just become incredibly vast. In addition, any sugya taken on its own, okay, can be interpreted in different ways. Rashi, as I mentioned, chose one way, sometimes two, but usually one way. But he was very careful. Rashi knew there were certain, that sometimes there were more than one way to understand the sugya, and he formulates his discussion in such a way as to, you know, sort of fend off, reject implicit objections, or to say, don't interpret this way. That's called, later on in the world of Pilpul, that's called Shmirah. Rashi Nishmar, Rashi was careful not to interpret this way, so he added this word or that word. That's, and in fact, he wrote with that kind of precision. That's why it's not kvetching to be, to weigh every single word that Rashi says. Rashi, as my teacher, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, always says, you have to be mishabed yourself to Rashi, because every single word was carefully weighed. Just like in the Rambam. Okay, but Tosfos, what did Tosfos do? Perish a kuntris. By the way, why is it called a kuntris? Why is Rashi called a kuntris? What? Why?
When he had a book that was next to the Gemara, it wasn't printed with the Gemara.
Correct. It was a separate book. So therefore, quintarius is a five-sided folded little notebook. Okay, and it would be Rashi's parish was not included in the Gemara until it was printed in the late 15th, early 16th century. Although there are manuscripts where they decided they wanted to anticipate Schottenstein or whoever else, and we have Gemaras where the Sofer decided, why shouldn't I bother? I'll just sort of say, put Rashi into the text of the Gemara. Just, you don't have to go back and forth, you just read straight. But that's not a good idea, because that sort of like forfends any possibility of any kind of independent or alternative interpretations. It's the danger for, I would never accuse anybody here of that, but it's the danger of just picking up Schottenstein or one of the knockoffs and just reading and thinking, oh, I now understand the Gemara, when in fact, if you look at, you know, you could, if you just have the Gemara, you will understand that Tosfos and Ramban or the Rashba or whoever could read the same sugya straight through very differently than Rashi, and you might, you'll end, if you're just hanging on to Schottenstein, then you're going to end up, you're not going to end up anywhere. So you've got to be, you have to be careful. In any event, I just came across an example of that in my own learning. There's a sugya in Ksuvis, where Machlokish Rav Yochanan and Resh Lokish, it's a whole discussion about whether the use of shtar. I don't know if you had it in shir or not, but anyways, where Chachmei Sforad I think the sugya is based on one issue of Yischaivus, and Rashi Tosfos think it's Hodos, and you from point A to point Y, you read the sugya totally differently based on what you think they're talking about. So, you know, it's not such a good idea. Anyway, so what it's supposed to do, number one, they assume the Gemara is a whole, a unified whole. B, they present, because they're convinced, alternative interpretations of sugyas to those presented by Rashi. And what, and usually, or very frequently, they do so in light of the fact that now the whole shas is available to them. They'll say, Rashi, if Rashi said X, but how could Rashi say X in over here and over there and over there? You got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 sugyas which contradict Rashi's reading of the sugya here. So Rashi, in fact, made possible, how could Tosfos do it? Because Rashi made those sugyas available. Because the whole shas was now open, was now an open book. So Rashi himself made possible this sort of global mode of learning that the Tosfos advocated. By the way, in a sense, there's nothing Tosfos does that the Gemara doesn't do. I want to be very clear. There were those who like to argue that Jews don't do anything on their own, everything's outside influence. Methodologically, okay, what the Tanayim did with the Psukim of the Chumash and the Tanakh, and the Amorayim did with the words of the Tanayim, Tosfos does with the Shas. It's the same method of Torah Sheva'al Peh applied to the Gemara as a whole. It's the same assumptions. Just like we said the Torah was written absolutely with precision because it's given by God and dictated by God. And just as we assume that the Tanayim also spoke with precision, so we assume that the Amorayim, that's a cultural issue, it's an assumption. Just like God and nature do nothing in vain, as Rav Sadia Gaon says in the Emunot V'Deot. So the bottom line is that what the Baalei HaTosfos did was to remap and to expand the horizons of halacha beyond anything that anybody had ever imagined prior to that. Because it's only once you compare and contrast. You ever do comparative lit in high school, where you compare like two authors and stuff like that? You find out that the depths of your understanding are way beyond anything that you when you read the book in the first place. And Rabbeinu Tam and his trusty general, Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampierre, the Riyaz Zalkain, did this for Ganshas, from Brachas to Nida. Thousands and thousands and thousands of insights and ideas, each one of which you can run with in all kinds of different directions. And basically, the revolution, the change in Talmud Torah, and we still learn in this Derech HaLimud, okay? The revolution, the one who gets the credit for doing it is Rabbeinu Tam. And the ones who advanced it are two of Rabbeinu Tam's major Talmidim, one of them being the Ri, and the other one being Rav Shimshon of Sons, the Rosh Mishantz, who, even though they're not always mentioned, at the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of Tosfos, even if it's anonymous, basically came out of the Batei Medrash of Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri, and the Rosh Mishantz. Okay. Yeah, later people add footnotes and additions and this and that, but the real work gets done by these three Baalei Tosfos and their immediate Talmidim. Not unlike the way that let's do it this way. Just not unlike the way that the Brisker Revolution was wrought by Rab Chaim and Rab Velvel in the Rav, and there were zillions of people that are constantly writing little chops and variations on this one and that one and this shot and that shot, the other shot, and so on and so forth. Those are footnotes. That's not creation out of whole cloth. You're going in a derech. The people who, in this case, the one who set the derech was Rab Chaim in his immediate circle. The same way, Rabbeinu Tam, in his immediate circle, they set the derech, and everybody else sort of walked and made their little hops, which is nice, it's fine. But it's much easier to walk in a paved road than it is to pave the road. Okay. If you combine Rabbeinu Tam, okay, is it clear what I said so far? Yes.
So did Rashi disagree with the fundamental assumption of Tosfos?
No, I think... It's interesting. It's a good question. My impression is that Rashi, first of all, it's clear that Rashi made Tosfos possible. Number two, listen, Rabbeinu Tam did most of it, all of his creativity was after Rashi died, so we don't know what he would have thought. You know, I guess these things like, we don't believe in necromancy, you're not allowed to ask the dead. My impression is that let me put it this way. The obvious comparison is Rashi in his Perush on Tana, on Chumash, is very, very based on Medrash. Rashbam, his anacle, is the opposite. Rashbam is this study Chumash on its own terms without Chazal. So Rashbam says in the introduction to in the beginning of his Perush on Vayeshev that Rashi, his grandfather, Rashbam was Rabbeinu Tam's older brother, but he was much, much older, and he learned with the Zeta, and he was the Zeta's, he was Rashi's secretary for a while, and so on. He says that his grandfather said that basically that if he had the time, he would go the way that Rashbam was going. You know, it's less Chazal, and now to move to once he interpreted all of Tanakh into light of Chazal, now is the time is to move on and to understand Tanakh in its own terms, without reference to Chazal. That's the implication that Rashbam makes. I think I wouldn't be surprised if something similar would be the case here. Okay, but it's hard to know. Rashi may very well have been sitting there listening to the Anaklach and the Ori Anaklach going Netzchunei Banai. I'm sure that would not have been a terrible experience for him. Okay. We're worried. Okay. Anyways, in light now, if you put together the sort of multi-answered Medrash Tillim that we talked about last week, where there, on every question there's Memtes 49 ways one way, 49 ways the other way, and everybody's right, but you're poskin on a sort of on a point by point basis. Add to that the fact that when you can compare and contrast two sugyas, you might have more than one answer. And how many Tosfos do you have where for every kasha you have three or four different answers, right? Inami this, inami that, thinking it this way, thinking it that way, this chilek, that chilek, the other chilek. There's no reason to decide. You just bring it all and everything's grist to the mill for further Havanas HaTorah, for further understanding and deepening of appreciation of what the Torah is trying to say. Because the logical possibilities and the Gemara is so vast that there, you know, you can compare and contrast all kinds of things. And come to all kinds of conclusions. And sometimes they're from areas of Torah that are totally different. You wouldn't put them together initially. I'll give you an example. Earlier in this month, you learned the sugya of the question of whether you can derive. I mean, I'm assuming you went straight through line by line. The whole question about whether how do you derive kesef shtar and bia, right? So at one stage, I think it's daftal and manalot, the Gemara wants to know about where a woman could buy her way out of a wedding, just like she can get into a wedding with get married through kesef, she should be able to get out with kesef, right? And they compare the fact that you can get married with a shtar, get out with a shtar. What does the Gemara say? What does the Gemara say? You can't use kesef. One reason you shouldn't be able to use kesef to get out of a wedding. Marriage. No, where else does that come up? Where else have you heard that expression? Anybody? Where? Shofar. By where?
Shofar.
By shofar. Would you normally put together shofar with kesef kedushin? No, but it's something to think about. Did they mean it? Was it just a drift? You understand? It's all. Look at number 11 on the sheet. The marshal in that same introduction I told you about. Writes, he characterizes the Tosfos and say, Shehem asuat the Talmud kakadur, vavchuhu vigilgiluhu mimakom lemakom v'nimtzam yushar haTalmudu mikushar. He said that what basically the Tosfos relate to the Gemara as a self-contained whole, as a sphere. Kadur is a ball is a sphere. Sphere is the most perfect for your Star Trek fans. The most Spock once said this. The sphere is the most perfect geometric figure. The thing about the sphere is everything relates to everything else. It's an all integrated whole. Endless possibilities. So they rolled it this way, they rolled it that way, and it's all integrated mechubar mechushar. And it also goes very far. You can roll it as far as you want. The wheel is the most important, one of the most important inventions ever had. Once the Shita of Balei HaTosfos begins to spread, it spreads like wildfire. With two significant implications or ramifications. Number one, look at number 12. I cited for you the text of the introduction of the Rav Moshe of Mikusi to the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol. I mentioned to you last week that that Ashkenazim in general don't write codes. They write collections of Fiske Halacha, but they don't say this is it, finished. Okay, they collect things. They have all kinds of collections of Divrei of Fiske Halacha and Shuvas, but it's left much very open ended. Not unlike the method of Limud that we've been talking about. One of the only exceptions to this was written is the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, which was written by Rabbi Moshe ben Yaakov of Kusi in the year 1247. He was an unabashed admirer of the Rambam. He was in Spain earlier in life. He was in southern France. Interesting, he says he would go. He went through southern France and northern Spain, exhorting people first of all to say Divrei Hesorus v'Yira Shemayim, and also get people put on tefillin and put mezuzahs on their doors. I like to call him the first Lubavitcher. He came back to France. He was involved in the trial of the Talmud in 1240, which is another story. We have to go into, and there's no time to go into right now. And he decided that what was necessary was that Ashkenaz needed a code. So what he did was he took the Mishnah Torah, restructured it. Instead of being 14 books, he put it into two parts, the Mitzvot Taseh, Mitzvot Lo Taseh. He basically copies out the Rambam almost word for word, and he tacks on the Gemaras that are relevant and also the opinions of the Ashkenazim, doing to the Rambam precisely what I mentioned the Ramod did to Mishulchan Aruch last week, that he basically undermines the Rambam's project by adding the words of the Balei HaTosfos, but makes the book accessible to everybody. Did he intend this to be the final word in Halacha? Apparently not. Look what he writes. He says, Yesh me hamon ha'am. There are people who say, Shomrim malanu l'mitzvot seder kodeshim, kal v'chomer l'mitzvot seder zra'im, l'mitzvot seder taharot. What do we need to learn kodeshim, zra'im, and taharos for? V'dvorim she'im noagim b'zman hazeh. It's not relevant. We should learn the halacha l'maaseh only. Al yomar adam kein. People shouldn't say that. Ki ha'mitzvot asher tziva adon ha'olam, yesh leida yesodotehem, af al pi she'inam tzrichim ata. Ki al kol ha'mitzvah nitzavenu v'lomadetem osam, ne'amar, shmor et kol ha'mitzvah asher anochi metzaveh etchem v'chulei, ne'amar, u'shmartim mitzvotai v'asitem otam. Ha lamadeto asher ha'shmira v'asir shnei dvorim heim, ki ein ha'shmira el ha'balev, sh'ne'amar ki na'im ki tishmerem, u'bebitnecha yekonu yachdav al sfatecha, v'chein amru rabotenu, u'shmartim zu ha'mishna v'asitem zu ha'asir. There's a separate kiyum in Yedias HaTorah. It doesn't have to be. In other words, this is the opposite of Spain. The mitzvah is Yediyas HaTorah. You have a direct line. There's a direct line from here to Nefesh HaChaim and to Hadiology and Lutzish Yeshivas. The mitzvah is Yediyas HaTorah. Halacha is very nice. It's very important. You have to be shomer mitzvahs. But Talmud Torah is achieved through understanding and knowledge, which means ultimately possibilities and learning are its bread and butter, because you don't have to come down on that side. And in the world of Talmud Torah, whether you're learning Zvachim or you're learning Shabbos, it's the same difference. That's one implication of the Shita of the Balei HaTosfos. Second implication is a little bit less happy, and goes back to what we talked about last time as well, about how do you cultivate your relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Where is the place for Ruchnius in all of this? The assumption was apparently among the Balei HaTosfos, like Rabbi Thomas says, for example, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, you get to it later on, that the person should divide his time into thirds. Lola Mishalesh Adam Shnosav, Shlish B'Mikra, Shlish B'Mishnah, Shlish B'Gemara. Mishnah means probably probably means learning, we call Bekias. Talmud probably means learning Iyun. Mikra means learning Tanakh. And Rebbe Tzadok says, no, we don't need that anymore. Just learn Gemara. If you learn Gemara, you get it all. You get Midas, you got Psukim, you got Mishnayish, you got Gemara, you got everything you want. Learn Gemara, that will solve all of it. That'll provide you with your entire internal spiritual and intellectual religious life, and you'll also know how to learn Paschen Shilas. The problem with that is that number one, Psak Halacha can suffer. Number two, it raises the possibility of intellectualism. What do you mean by intellectualism? A person can be very smart. A person can be a brilliant Talmud Chacham and not be a good person. On the contrary, since Chiddush requires a person to work on his own stuff and say, I think that, the minute you say I, if you're really impressed with yourself, what is that? What can that lead to? Arrogance, no? And if you get too arrogant, you could end up being problematic in terms of one's, in terms of your own neshama. By the way, what is the one word that you cannot never hear Rashi say? Rashi never says I. How often does Rashi say Ani Omer? You can count them on one hand. Generally, when Rashi comes out from behind the curtain, it's in order to say what? Lo Yadati Perusho. Rashi is the embodiment of Anava. He hides behind his Perush. However, when you, because he's taking you by the hand and saying, this is what this means. When you're talking about there's a problem and I say this is the distinction and I say this and I say that, the possibility of your ego getting a better view arises. It was as an antidote to this that a movement arose in Ashkenaz, among other things, other reasons behind it, called Hasidut Ashkenaz, to teach Musar and Anava. And to say, you know what? You're not the smartest guy in the world. There's also Kodesh Baruch Hu. He also knows something. Maybe Chazal knew something too. You know, it's put things into perspective. One of the most famous comments that they make in Sefer Chassidim is Siman Tav Shin Nun Bet. I have it here, number 13. Ktiv. Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about the Torah. Later on, the Jews despised God's wisdom. And the real chokmah is Yisra. But Lo yilmod adam shum Torah ela hamivya lidei yirat shemayim sheneemar hen yirat Hashem hi chokma. Kama chokmot amar Shlomo v'lo nitnu likatev ela hamiviyot lidei yirat shemayim yirat Hashem sheneemar sof tavar kol nishmat el kim yira bet mitzvot mitzvotav yishemor ki zeh kol ha'adam. So even with the official line of the Bali Tosfos was that you can get everything out of learning Gemara in the proper modality, there was a fear that Yirat Shamayim would suffer, and the proper Anava, which is necessary to be able to properly be a Lamdan, will suffer, and therefore came Chassid Ashkenaz and said you have to really cultivate Yirat Shamayim. This became an endemic problem. You remember what the Rabbeinu Bachus issue was? He said, okay, you want to solve your problem, you don't want to get go off in some kind of tangents, so learn Musar or learn philosophy. In this case, they learn Musar. Or learn Yirat Shamayim. By the way, none other than Chaim Volozhiner. In the fourth shah of Nefesh HaChayim, it's really interesting. He presents what Torah Lishma, which means just knowing Torah, just like the smog. And he stops. Mamish stops in his tracks. He says, you know what? Before you sit down to learn, you should sit there and cultivate Yirat Shamayim. Because basically he says that Yirat Shamayim is the storehouse within which Talmud Torah has to happen. And then he goes on. It's like he took a break. It's like a commercial. All right, this is the program. The program is Torah Lishma, but I'm going to take a commercial. Now comes a commercial break from the Kodesh Baruch Hu's representatives, but it's got to be done by Yirat Shamayim, otherwise it becomes it gets undermined. Closed. Close the curtain, and we'll go on with the show, with the presentation. That's why. What movement arose in Lithuania as a result of this? The Muslim movement. Precisely. It's precisely why Rabbi Yisrael Salanter preached Musar. He wasn't anti-Talmud Torah in the Lifshitz sense. Because this balance between spirituality and learning, and spirituality and mitzvahs had to be maintained. Okay. The revolution that Baal HaTosfos wrought, it's so all-inclusive and swept the world in front of it, because Talmud Torah could grow. That it conquered everything in front of it. Okay. And to this day, all learning is basically footnotes to Tosfos. So, in the year 1211, the Rabbeinu Tam died in 1171. The Rebbe died around 1195. In 1211, Rabbi Shimshon Misantz and his brother Rabbi Yitzchak ben Avram get on a boat with, according to tradition, 300 Baal HaTosfos, and they move to Eretz Yisrael. They move to Akko. Why Akko? Because Akko was the last crusader bastion in Eretz Yisrael, and the crusaders were, by and large, French, and you go where you can speak the language, because as any Ole will tell you, I came to Israel knowing speaking Hebrew, because when I was a kid, you could actually go to school and come out with fluent Hebrew. On the contrary, when I came here, my Hebrew was too good, because we learned Hebrew, proper Hebrew, and it took me 4 or 5 years of teaching to dumb down my Hebrew to be able to be understood by Israelis. But that's another story. You usually go where the other people know the language, and in Akko they spoke French. Baal HaTosfos spoke French, so they ended up in Akko. In any event. By the 13th century, most of Shas had been conquered by the Baal HaTosfos, and everything after that is additions and additions and editing and reorganization and stuff like that. Which means that the central achievement of the Baal HaTosfos, which was done, as I said, by Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri, and the Rashmi Shantz, primarily was ready to be transferred. And it does. Just as things were sort of running out of steam in France, two people come on the scene in northern Spain who take it to another level. Those two individuals are Rabbeinu Yonah Gerondi and the Ramban, who is also from Gerona. Okay. Both of them were born, the Rabbeinu Yonah was born earlier, the Ramban was probably born in 1195. In other words, the Ramban is coming to his own as a young man just when the Rashmi Shantz is moving to Eretz Yisrael. Rabbeinu Yonah is a bit older than him, maybe 20 years older. Maybe he's born 1170 something. Rabbeinu Yonah, but they're both from Gerona. Gerona, or Gerona, with the way that it's not properly pronounced, in Spanish, probably pronounced Gerona, is northeastern Spain, north of Barcelona. Why is that important? Because that part of Spain is not Spain. That part of Spain is known as Catalonia. Catalonia, politically and culturally, was always more French than it was Spanish. So people are constantly moving back and forth. Okay? I'll give you an example. The Balamor was also from Gerona, Rabbi Zrachi Alevi. He was Barcelona. He was born in Barcelona. He moves and spends his entire career in Pasquier, and then he moves home to Barcelona at the end of his life. In other words, he, by the way, he apparently lived down. You know, who was the Balamor's big opponent? Who were his two big opponents? The Ramban and who else? The Ravid. The Balamor and the Ravid spent their entire life sniping at each other. I was fantasized that they both wanted to marry the Rashiva's daughter, and the Ravid ended up doing it. He married the daughter of the Ramban ben Yitzchak of Narbona, and so he. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the two of them were at each other's throats. They lived across the street from each other, and this one wrote a sefer, the other one wrote Hasagas. This one wrote another sefer, the other one wrote Hasagas. And then back and forth, they're at it like constantly yelling at each other and anyways, in the best based Medrash style. And the Ravid certainly wasn't ashamed to. Excuse me. wasn't inhibited of in terms of sharing criticism. Anyways, so you have that. So there's a tremendous amount of contact between France and Provence and this part of Catalonia, and seeking more Talmud Torah. Rabbeinu Yonah, we know in terms of Shari Tshuva and stuff like that. Rabbeinu Yonah went to Normandy to study in the yeshiva of the major Balei Tosfos at the time in Evreux to learn the Derech. And more than that, the Ramban was his cousin. It's also his mechutin. They were first cousins, and the Ramban's son married Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter. They were close family. And the Ramban in one place says that he had a chiddush which he sent to Rabbeinu Yonah to present to the Balei Tosfos in Evreux to see if it was always gehalten, to see if it made sense to them or not. The result of, and Rabbeinu Yonah comes back to Catalonia, and he writes Chidushim in the style of the Balei Tosfos. He brings the method with him, and whatever information and knowledge and whatever the traditions of Balei Tosfos he had acquired in France, and he transplants them in Spain. The result in terms of what we have available to us are what's called the Aliyot Rabbeinu Yonah. Okay, why are they called the Aliyot of Rabbeinu Yonah? We only have them of Baba Basra, but he wrote them on a lot of other things. Because he would say, after learning a sugya, Allah lanu kachav, Allah lanu kachav. Now, the result was as follows. Now, that's a very significant statement. Why? Because generally, it's to go native. You know what that means? What does it mean when someone goes native? In the world of diplomacy, there's a principle that if you send an ambassador somewhere, you shouldn't let them stay in where they are for too long. Because after a while, they identify more with the people among whom they're living than the country that sent them. That's called going native. In other words, I identify more with the needs of the local population than with the country that I represent. So you have to move them around and so keep them on the go so that they, and you have to bring them home periodically for what's called in Hebrew chufshat moledet to recharge the batteries in the orientation. So Rabbeinu Yonah was powerfully affected, both in his hashkafa and in his learning by the Balei Tosfos, but he didn't go native. What do I mean he didn't go native? The mode in which he wrote, okay, is very different than that of the Balei Tosfos. Okay? And this is going to be even more true of his cousin, the Ramban. Tosfos writes on every line of the Gemara. They map out every single Havamina. Why does the Havamina this way and that way? Whether it has a halakhic ramification, a practical ramification, or not. What Rabbeinu Yonah starts and the Ramban continues is to write something called Chidushim. For the first time the word comes up. What are Chidushim as opposed to Tosfos? Tosfos are notes along line by line. Chidushim are little essays where you zoom in on the central question or questions of a sugya. You bring to bear all the Gemaras and the Shi and the approaches that are possible, and you work out whatever your interpretation is. Then, the job of the learner is to go back and see how that fits in the words of the Gemara. But in terms of what you're doing, you're following? You're basically focusing in on the nub of the sugya with an eye always to Lasuke Shmatita Aliba Dehilchasa. So what Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva and the Ran do subsequently is basically to adopt the tools of the Balei Tosfos, but to apply them in a very genuine, authentic Sephardic way. Because you're always keeping, if you're a Sephardi at Rishon, your eye is always on the prize. Now, Now, your conclusions may in fact will take you far afield from where perhaps your ancestors in Spain went, because now you have the broad shoulders of what the Tosfos did to see that there's a lot more involved here than what we thought previously. But in terms of what you're looking for, it doesn't significantly change. That's on the one hand, and the Ramban does that, but to an even greater degree. The Ramban, by the way, is 1195 to 1270. He wants to know what the nafkamina is. He wants to know what the direct impact of things are. He'll work through the questions, work through the sides, with an eye towards the ultimate answer. That's number one. Number two. Take a look at the I brought you on page. Hold on. Oh, I made a mistake here. Oh, there it is. No, it was number 14. The Ramban, what I said, takes his ball and runs with it further than anybody else. The Ramban ultimately is the ultimate perfect merger of Ashkenaz and Sfar and Spain in this regard. There is a fundamental difference between the Balei Tosfos and the Ramban and many Sephardic Rishonim on another line. Ultimately, like the Yad Ramah, the goal of the Ramban is to defend and to bolster and to dialectically base the traditions of Spain. Or in general, to defend the older authorities. If you think about the stuff what did the Ramban write on? When he wrote, for example, he wrote Hasagas on the Rambam's Sefer Mitzvahs. What was his purpose there? His purpose was to defend the Halachas Gedolos. Halachas Gedolos had different enumeration of all the mitzvahs than the Rambam, and he thought it was wrong. He had to defend the Halachas Gedolos because you defer to the tradition you received. And in fact, his entire life is devoted, you'll see in a minute, he writes in the introduction to the Hasagas on Sefer Mitzvahs as follows. Batisaini ruach lamed aleihem schut, meaning the earlier authorities. The libi arev lahodiya al arab shelo ba'da tachlid ve lamofet lo karev. That the Rambam did not refute any of the Baal Halachas Gedolos. Ubemakom asher chashav lo amad ve lo yashav. Vinanim cheshki v'atzi liyot larishonim talmid. L'kayem divrehem ulahamid, la'asot otam l'tzavari ravid v'al yedid tamid, al yaday tamid, v'lo eyeh lehem chamor nosei sfarim tamid. He says, I'm going to understand them, but I have to defend them. So he defends the world of Spain that he inherited, that of the Gaonim, with the tools of the Balei Tosfos, which is what he does also when he defends the Rif against the Ravid and the Balamor in the Milchamas, which he writes when he's 19. Okay, the method is French, but the purpose is quintessentially Spanish. You see it nicely in the last Makor that I have here. In the early 1230s, there was a world war about studying philosophy or studying the Rambam. There were three stages of this, the so-called Maimonidean controversy. The first one was an attack on the Rambam, which was led, by the way, by the Yad Ramah, of all people. In the late 12th century, early 13th century, the second one was in the 1230s, and the last one was that we culminated in the Cheirim of the Rajba against the irresponsible study of philosophy. Some people will tell you the Rajba in 1305 banned the study of philosophy. That's not true. The Rajba said that before you study philosophy and do advanced metaphysics, you have to learn Gemara, and you have to know Halacha, and you've got to do all of the preliminary sciences. You have to have, before you do a PhD in philosophy, you have to get a BA. And you should get Smicha before that. I mean, if I put this in contemporary parlance. The irresponsible study of philosophy, not studying science per se. Anyways, in the 1230s, the second stage of this controversy broke out. And the Balei Tosfos, who they weren't big Torah Mada fans, apparently put a cherem on even having the Sefer Mada and the Mor Nebuchim in the person's home. Tragically, some Kanoim in Provence ratted out the Rambam to the Inquisition, and the Inquisition confiscated and burned copies of the Mishnah Torah and the Mor Nebuchim, Sefer Mada and the Mor Nebuchim, apparently in Montpellier. That was not just tragedy per se. Up until that time, the church had never interfered in the internal workings of the Jewish community. But once they were introduced into the internal workings of the Jewish community and asked to adjudicate an internal fight over heresy, the church saw that as a legal precedent to fight heresy, or what people, the Jews said it was heresy, wherever they found it. Some eight, six, seven years later, they accused the Gemara of being heretical. And in fact, it was put on trial in 1240. Rav Moshe of Kusi participated in that trial, and 24 cartloads of Gemaras, of manuscripts of Gemaras, were burnt. Apparently, and anybody been to Paris, in the area in front of the Hotel de Vosges, near the Plätzl, something which really put an end to learning in Spain. And to this day, on Tisha B'Av, towards the end of Kinnis, we have this Zekina of Shali Shrufa Be'esh, which was composed by Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who was a young Talmud of Rabbi Chil of Paris, who at the time was the great defender of the Gemara at this trial, and he was an eyewitness to the burning of the Talmud and wrote that kina. Anyways, before the burning, the Ramban wrote to the rabbis of France, with whom he had a kesher, right? His cousin had been in Evreux, and he'd been in contact, and so on. So he writes them a letter called Terem Ene Ani Shogeg. Look at the last two lines. He says, "Shamedina zot meshubeshet b'giyasot lo efshar l'maitei kadam rabbanan." Travel is very difficult. It's very dangerous. I would have come before you, Rabotenu atzorfatim talmidechem anu umeimechem anu shotim. We drink your waters. We have adapted your entire shita, but as I said, in a specific Spanish way. Okay. So the first contribution of the Ramban in that regard, as I said, was to take the Shita of Valetosis, to take it to another level, to apply it to Spanish ambiance. There's an extra piece to this, and that's very, very important for your daily lives in yeshiva, for your daily lives in learning until you're 120. And I wouldn't have been able to say this as well or as clearly. It had not been the fact that there were no coincidences, we like to say in Israel, Ein Mikrim. Dafka yesterday, I received a copy of an article by Professor Soloveitchik, which Dafka deals with the Meiri. But he makes the point that I'm about to share with you, is typically brilliant and cogent and persuasive way. When you learn a Tosfos will often resolve a lechora, contradiction, or a problem in a sugya by saying, this is dealing with this and this is dealing with that. Tosfos, Professor Soloveitchik points out, does not usually, if ever, tell you what the underlying rationale is for the distinction. In other words, you have to sit there and bang your head, what's Tosfos Shita? What lies that the chilek that Tosfos makes? I mean, that's what we're trying to do. What's Tosfos Shita? What's Rashi Shita, right? What rationale underlies the distinction? And what are the implications of that distinction? What prior understanding or what insight leads to Tosfos to make the distinction between two sugyas in a specific manner? Leaves it open. What the Ramban, followed by the Rashba, followed by the Ritva, followed by the Ran do is to provide precisely that clarity. Why is it a machaya? Okay, the Ramban, let me make something very clear. The Ramban was the author of this entire Mahalach. The clearest writer in the world, he wasn't. Anybody struggled with Chiddush Ramban or with the Perush Ramban on Chumash knows it's, and never mind on Chumash, which is before he even started really writing extensively when he was only 19. It's hard. You have to really be, it takes a lot of Amelus Batorah to hack through, even though that's one of the great moments of Lumdus is going through a Machlokas, the Muhammad, still it's not easy. Writing apparently didn't come easily to him. The Rashba, on the other hand, a Machaya. You open up the Rajba, it's like FM radio, you just read, well, you have to work hard, but you read, he's clear. Okay? And generally, I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm going to confess to you, I don't know what you guys do. I know I wish I had a dollar for every time that I couldn't figure out what the Ramban wanted, and I look up the Rajba, and it's easier to understand the Ramban through the Rajba than the other way around. Okay? But that's what these Rishonim did. When I said they take Tosfos to another level, they start thinking in terms of the conceptual ideas that underlie Tosfos's intuitive distinctions between sugyas. Okay, sometimes it even the Ritzvah is like this a lot, and even the Ran also. Okay, it even begins to sound like Yeshiva Shaloshin. What's the classic example? The Ran and his parish on Nedarim, the Rashi on Nedarim is problematic, so we always learn with the Ran, okay? The Ran and the Beis Hamidrash and Aleph of Nedarim, he's the one that creates the famous chilek. What is the difference between a Shavuot and a Neder? What is it, no? He's the one that comes up with Gavr Chetzer. I remember when we learned Nedarim with Rav Soloveitchik, that's all, that they said, I love it when the Ran talks Rav Chaim's Lashon. What do you mean? Rav Chaim was using the Ran's Lashon. The neder is the chalos is in the chetza, and there's all the question of meal of economics, not even because of economics and so on, because you can basically instill a status on an object, whereas the shvua you bind yourself. So it's a gavra, it's a chetza, no. And the ritva, I mean, if you've been learning the ritva keseder in kedushin, I mean, there you go, because they go run with it. That's what the Sfardim did. So in other words, on the one hand, the Sephardic Rishonim applied the method to a specifically Spanish modality and with a search for Asuke Shat Alibid Elchasa. On the other hand, in the world of the Shita, of the method of Balei Tosfos, they took it to a whole new level by examining the underlying conceptual roots of the distinctions and the various insights that the Balei Tosfos have in potential in their comments on directly on the Gemara. There is one other this is my observation, not for Soloveitchik. I mean, he may agree, may not. I don't know. At least in the Ramban, there's a very striking difference between Ramban and Tosfos in another area. Tosfos, at least to the degree that I can, to the degree that I'm familiar, don't build buildings. Don't make huge structures. Okay. So, for example, I'll give you two examples. The Gemara Pesachim Daf Zayin Amud Beis, Zayin Amud Aleph, Daf Zayin Amud Beis. Beis has a whole long, very difficult sugya about Birkas HaMitzvos. When do you say le and when do you say al? And back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth. And the upshot, if you read through all the Balei Tosfos and the poskim and the Balei Tosfos and so on, is forget it. I can't. There's no rhyme. There's no reason. Forget it. It is what it is. And they say the bracha and goodbye. If you look in the Ramban on that sugya, the Ramban breaks his head. He says, no, there has to be a system. There has to be an underlying system where we can integrate all of the brachas. Sometimes al, sometimes le, sometimes this, sometimes that, and he strives mightily to create an entire conceptual structure to understand how brachas work. Okay, that's a very big difference. That's taking one step further than Tosfos. Another example: there is a phenomenal that one of the Shas issues that pops up is the question of garmi. What's garmi? Anybody know what garmi is? There is nezek, and there is grumma. There is nezek, where, you know, I'll go break a window, I'll punch your nose out, or whatever it is. Okay? On the other hand, there's grumma, where I set things up that I do indirect causation for damages. Okay? So nezek is chayiv, and grumma benizokin is pater. There's a middle category, okay, called garmi, which is more direct causation than grumma, but more indirect than regular nezek. And the question is whether dying died into the garmi or not, whether we in fact do assume that garmi, which is this middle case, is chayiv or not. We paskin it is. And the Gemara has needs X number of I don't remember exactly how many, approximately eight cases of garmi, might be more, I don't remember. You know, truth is, forget it, I don't remember how many there are. There are a number of them. Tosfos assumes that the issur is the Rabbanon, that really they're part of the Chazal asked it because it's close enough to direct causation to warrant an action. And the Ri said, leave me alone. Read the Ri. Rabbeinu Tam's, you know, right-hand man. Talmud Mubak, a nephew. Says, leave me alone. It's a bunch of gezeiras. Chazal said, this should be usur, that should be usur. There's no rhyme, there's no reason, there's no systematic thing. On a case-by-case basis, Chazal decided to usur these cases and say, you're chayiv and goodbye. Ramban writes a whole kuntres dina de garmi. By the way, Ravarn Lichtenstein, you should have Rufur Shlema, has an entire sefer on the dina de garmi in the collected shiurim, which is stunning. Let me put it this way: I learned dina de garmi with the Rav, and I have, and in fact, Rabbi Heshi Reichman at YU wrote up those shiurim. We were sitting next to each other in a shiur at the time, and he's older than me. But anyways. We strove mightily, but I didn't understand Dina de Gemini until I learned it with the Shura, with Ravard Shura himself. Anyways, the Ramban says, forget it! There's no such thing as a bunch of gezeiras. There has to be a systematic conceptual system, put all of these in. So he uses the tools of the Tosfos to go beyond the Tosfos and to develop an entire conceptual structure which accommodates every single case that Chazal decided should be chayiv. And that is when the school that was founded, which the unofficial founder of Ben Yonah, the real founder is Ramban, because his Talmidim, the Rajba and the Ra'a, and their Talmud, the Talmidim, the Ritva and the Ran, follow up with the death of the Ran in the early 14th century. The era of the Rishonim comes to an end. I know you'll look in the Sifrei HaKlolim and they'll tell you that the first Achron is Rabbi Yosef Karo. He's also Rishon, he's also an Achron, sort of like Rav. That may be okay for Psak Halacha, but they're talking about who can disagree with who. But from the point of view of Derech HaLimud, the Derech HaLimud shifts among Ashkenazim in the early 14th century, and among Sephardim in the late 14th century, early 15th century, and you really begin to have the beginning of the era of the Achronim. The difference between Rishonim and Achronim in that regard is simply that whereas Rishonim deal directly with the Gemara and they accept or reject the opinions of other Rishonim based on whether they like them or not, or they accept them or not, they see the cogent, Achronim work through Rishonim. You try to understand the Gemara through the Rishonim. How did the Rishon understand? How did the Rishon prefer? How did Rashi? What would Rashi reply to Tosfos? That kind of learning. Maharsha, Pnei Yehoshua, Megine Shlomo, that kind of Maram, that kind of Derech HaLimud. So that's a whole different ballgame. That you already find among the what we call late Rishonim in the 15th century in Spain and in Ashkenaz. Okay, so you know what the Kohen Gadol says after read Kriyas Torah on Yom Kippur afternoon, aside from go home and rest until this is your break. Yosi Masha Karasi Kasuf Kan, but I hope that this has helped in terms of putting stuff into perspective and be matzliach and learning.